Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. Winter is setting in Eastern Europe, and that means especially compounded hardships in Ukraine, thanks to Russia's deliberate targeting of Ukraine's power grid, which is hands down a war crime. It amounts to inflicting collective punishment on a civilian population that, for the most part, has had no role at all in the conflict or the issues that underlie it. We hear reports of people going without heat or water, yet the film we see at the nightly news suggests an almost life-as-normal existence in western Ukraine, so it's a little hard to reconcile the conflicting reports of desperation and destruction on the one hand and relative calm on the other. It's hard to imagine that all of that fighting not having a profound impact across the entire nation and the entire region as death tolls climb into the tens of thousands between both Russia and Ukraine. But there, too, reports vary broadly, as do reports about Ukrainian military successes and Russia's dwindling resources. There are also questions about whether the aid Western countries are sending to Ukraine is getting through or getting diverted. Still, the Western media, and to some extent the Russian media as well, seem to dismiss ever more routinely any prospect of a diplomatic solution. Yet what you don't hear from advocates of a military solution are what a post-war Ukraine and Russia would look like, regardless of who's declared the winner. Only in independent media will you find acknowledgement of the perspective that this war is not winnable by any party in any traditional sense, let alone what the West's broader motives might be. We can only speculate about Putin's motives, which may be largely separate from his stated reasons. It does seem clear, though, that for the war to end, some kind of conditions must be negotiated and agreed to. Yet in the West, an absolute Ukrainian victory is the only outcome being discussed. And of course, there's the looming threat of nuclear engagement, as both Russia and the U.S. have low-yield, so-called tactical nuclear weapons, and while both sides have pledged not to use them, neither side historically can be trusted, and Russia in particular may feel increasingly desperate if the Western reports are to be taken at face value. In today's show, we'll hear from a couple of foreign military policy experts on the matter. Scott Ritter is a former U.S. weapons inspector for the U.S. and UN weapons inspector for the U.S. and an outspoken critic of U.S. foreign policy since the war in Iraq, in which he plays a significant role. Douglas McGregor hails from the political right wing in the U.S. and has opposed the U.S. role in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. He's been accused of supporting Russia, but if you pay close attention to what he says here in this interview, his views are actually less partisan than they might appear at first. Anyway, it's our job here in community media to provide a broad array of perspectives and much background information as we can to break the binary gridlock and help folks see the both-and through the fog of either-or. So without necessarily endorsing today's speakers and their positions in whole or in part, I offer them here as food for thought to stimulate debate and nurture further inquiry.
War should be avoided at all costs. Nuclear conflict should never be contemplated. These truisms are often spoken, but rarely adhered to. Wars occur all too frequently, and so long as nations possess nuclear weapons, the use is contemplated on a continuous basis. The ongoing Ukrainian-Russian conflict has put the world's two largest nuclear powers on opposing sides, with the U.S. supporting a Ukrainian military that has become a de facto proxy of NATO, and Russia viewing its struggle with Ukraine as including the collective West. In this conflict, the U.S. went to great lengths to support Ukraine, while many academics such as Noam Chomsky and Jeffrey Sachs and military experts such as Douglas McGregor, Scott Ritter, and Richard Black have been warning since day one that the U.S. support would do nothing but destroying Ukraine. The Biden administration not only increased the financial and intelligence support, but also, as Scott Ritter claims, since April started to provide Ukraine with military experts on the ground. During this war, Russia captured 20% of the Ukrainian territory and Ukraine on July 27th in a counterattack, as Zelensky claimed, has liberated 2,000 square kilometers. Although mainstream media unanimously reported it as a stunning counteroffensive, and asked NATO to provide more military equipment to Ukrainians. But these 1,000 kilometers would make a meaningful change to the tide of war? Here we have CNN analyst Fade Zakaria in an interview with Lloyd Austin, United States Secretary of Defense. CNN analyst tries so hard to press in to provide longer-range weapons to Ukraine to make them capable to attack even deeper into Russian territory.
I was in Ukraine a couple of weeks ago and talked to a number of people there, including your counterpart. One of the things that they do say is that they would dearly wish for more American weaponry, but particularly longer-range weapons. The Biden administration has been hesitant to do that because of the fear of these weapons essentially reaching into Russia, seeming to be an attack on Russia. Now, my question to you is, Russia has just changed the game. They have annexed all this, the entire Donbass, all those four regions. So, in effect, any missile that hits Russian positions in the Donbass is already an attack on Russia. In this new circumstance, why not lean forward, give the Ukrainians the longer-range weaponry they're asking for? By Russian law, you're hitting Russia anyway when these missiles are hitting the Donbass.
You know, I talked to my counterpart, the Minister of Defense there in Ukraine, Minister Reznikov, routinely. As a matter of fact, I just talked to him last night. We talk about what's how the fight's going, what's needed, and what's upcoming. And we've been very effective in providing them those things that are very, very effective on a battlefield, and they have used them in the right way. So they have the capability with the HIMARS and the GMLRS, which is around that the HIMARS employs. They can range targets in almost every piece of Ukraine territory.
Well, Douglas McGregor believes that the reports of the mainstream media are nothing close to the reality of this war.
I think we have to be careful what we conclude based on the reports that come through the mainstream media, first of all, in the West. These latest counterattacks are in a series of counterattacks that have cost the Ukrainian forces enormous numbers of lives. We can't even begin to imagine how desperate the Ukrainian army must be at this point, having lost close to 100,000 dead. And the only thing I can think of is that they are desperate to try and drag in the United States and NATO on their behalf, and so they're launching these attacks relentlessly in the hopes they can create the illusion of success. The truth is that these counterattacks have achieved very, very little. The Russians are running what we would call in the West an economy of force mission in southern Ukraine. And they've given ground when they thought it was necessary to do so. But in most cases, the distance when we talk about giving ground is the distance perhaps in this area between Culpeper, Virginia and Warrenton, Virginia, or Warrenton, Virginia and Manassas. In other words, 23, 24 miles. Then it stops. The Russians adopt a new defensive position. The bulk of the regular Russian army is not involved in these things. And they are building up for what I think will be very substantial offensive operations in the future. Any army that has spent many years in garrison and takes the field in large numbers to conduct high-end conventional warfare is going to make some mistakes and have some problems. I don't see any of those really as being either irreversible or all that serious. I think people need to understand something, and I'm sure the Russian population is curious, because the entire approach to this campaign has been very different from what one would have normally expected from Russian military doctrine. But that's because this was always designed to be a limited operation to move into limited areas with the purpose of destroying Ukrainian forces. Now, that mission was largely accomplished. But there was a key underlying assumption, and that assumption was that Moscow would have someone to negotiate with, that there would be an interest in bringing the conflict to a close. I don't think Moscow ever thought that the United States would try to turn this into a desperate situation for Russia. And the Americans have made some serious mistakes in this connection. They assumed that they could crush Russia financially and economically. And they didn't understand that Russia stood outside of that system. They've also tried to isolate Russia from the rest of the world, when in fact the rest of the world, minus Europe and North America, is largely sided with Russia. So I think the United States has underestimated this. The other thing is the United States thought they could win by essentially exposing millions of Ukrainians to terrible conditions. I don't think that's worked very well. I think the Ukrainians have suffered terribly, and under normal circumstances, I think this would already be over. But London and Washington in particular want it to continue. So now the operation has to change in terms of character and purpose. And I think that's what we will see in the very near future. And that's the purpose behind the limited mobilization of 300,000 reservists. Well, expressing support for the position the United States takes falls far short of sending troops to fight in a war. There is no appetite whatsoever in Europe, with the possible exception of the Poles. Nowhere else in Europe is anyone interested in being dragged into a war with Russia. And right now, the support for Russia from from the United States' European allies is shrunk to a trickle. It's drying up. And we are now reaching the end of our war stocks. In the meantime, the predictions that the Russians would run out of munitions, the Russians would run out of tanks, everything else, all that's nonsense. The Russians have plenty of ammunition, plenty of equipment, and the bulk of their forces have not been engaged. The Russians have never committed more than 20% of the Russian regular army to Ukraine. Again, that's going to change at this point. I think Moscow has finally given up on the potential for any negotiated settlement. And then there's another aspect that has to be brought into this, and that's the economic damage done by the sanctions leveled at Russia to Europe. Europe's in a very serious position right now, particularly Germany. And frankly, Germany is the keystone in the edifice of NATO and the European Union. The Germans are furious. They're angry. They're frustrated. They don't understand what's happened. They're particularly frustrated with the Poles, who seem to be determined to find a way to war with Russia. I think we're going to see changes in the German and French and other European governments on the model of Mrs. Meloni's victory in Italy. And I think these will change the strategic complexion of the entire event. And Ukraine, by the way, is going to suffer terribly as the winter wears on. And there will be no help for Ukraine from the Europeans or the United States to deal with that effectively. You have to understand what mission the Russian military was given. And decisions were made early on regarding what kinds of forces would be used and how they would be employed. As I said, I expected a very different opening phase of the operation from the one that we witnessed. I never thought that over the space of 500, 600, 700 kilometers, piecemeal units of the Russian army would move in to Ukraine. I was quite shocked by that. But I didn't at the time understand President Putin's sensitivity to avoiding damage to infrastructure as well as to Ukrainians. He made it very clear that he was not interested in killing civilians under any circumstances. And contrary to what the Western media has reported, I think the Russians have exercised great restraint. Now, what has changed is the recognition that no one will negotiate. Europe is very vulnerable economically at this point. The winter is coming. He's now decided to increase the military power that he's prepared to employ. Most of the reservists will release Russian formations from elsewhere in Russia for duty in Ukraine. We're also seeing a lot of forces come in with equipment and weapon systems that we have not seen in the past. So I think at this stage of the game, Russia is winning. Russia is not going to lose. And we are going to witness offensives more on the model of what we have expected in the past but have not yet seen. And they will be devastating. The Ukrainians will not be able to withstand them.
Since the initiation of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, both the US and Russia have played their respective nuclear cards. Russia has made it clear that any intervention by NATO would be considered an existential threat to the Russian nation, thereby invoking one of the two clauses in the Russian nuclear posture in which nuclear weapons could be used. The other would be in response to a nuclear attack against Russia. The US has made it clear that any attack by Russia against a NATO member would invoke Article 5 of the NATO Charter, resulting in the totality of the alliance military capabilities, including nuclear weapons, being made available in response. So far, neither side has directly challenged the red line of the other, although the United States has edged right up to it with the provision of tens of billions of dollars of advanced weaponry, financial assistance, and intelligence and communication support for Ukraine. This material support isn't provided for Ukraine's defense, but rather to enable Ukraine to retake territory lost to Russia and to inflict losses among the Russian forces of such a magnitude as to weaken Russia for an extended period from the Western perspective. The massive infusion of military aid appears to be succeeding. Ukraine is perceived as having pushed back an initial Russian effort to capture Kyiv in the opening weeks of the conflict. It is also seen as having held back a concerted Russian offensive in the Donbass long enough to deploy a reconstituted army which is trained and equipped by NATO and succeeded in recapturing the totality of the Kharkov region. The fact that the Kyiv victory has been described by Russia as a strategic feint and not a defeat, and that the Kharkov offensive, together with a parallel failed offensive in Kherson, cost Ukraine so many casualties that it was more pyrrhic than political in nature. From the perspective of both Ukraine and NATO, the Russian army is no longer viewed as invincible, but actually vulnerable. Both NATO and Ukraine appear ready to continue an aggressive military posture designed to attract Russian forces while recapturing Ukrainian territory. For its part, Russia believes that it has the upper hand in the conflict, having both inflicted massive casualties on the Ukrainian military and seizing control of approximately 20% of Ukrainian territory. Moreover, by holding referenda in the occupied territories about joining Russia, all of which passed by an overwhelming majority, Russia has changed the very nature of the conflict, transforming it from a fight between Ukraine and Russia on Ukrainian soil to an existential battle with the collective West over Mother Russia itself. Russia has also ordered a partial mobilization of some 300,000 troops which, once trained and deployed into the Ukraine theater of operations, will provide sufficient military power to successfully complete Russia's original tasks, which are demilitarization and denazification. NATO and Ukraine both believe that the Russian forces, even after receiving the 300,000 mobilized troops, will not be able to defeat Ukraine. This inability to achieve the desired objectives, they believe, will compel Russia to resort to the use of tactical nuclear weapons on Ukrainian targets in order to break the will to resist on the part of the Zelensky government. The reality, however, is that Russian nuclear doctrine does not allow for such a scenario. Indeed, there are only two conditions where Russian nuclear doctrine permits the employment of nuclear weapons. Number one, in response to the use of nuclear and other types of weapons of mass destruction against it or its allies. The 2020 Russian Nuclear Posture Document states, number two, in the event of aggression against the Russian Federation with the use of conventional weapons when the very existence of the state is in jeopardy. The U.S. nuclear posture, however, does allow it. The United States will maintain the range of flexible nuclear capabilities. The 2018 U.S. Nuclear Posture Review declared, needed to ensure that nuclear or non-nuclear aggression against the United States, allies, and partners will fail to achieve its objectives and carry with it the credible risk of intolerable consequences for potential adversaries now and in the future. It should be noted that the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review was promulgated during the administration of President Donald Trump. Although the Biden administration initiated the NPR process in September 2021, it has yet to publish an updated document. By ignoring stated Russian nuclear policy and instead mirror imaging U.S. nuclear policy onto Russian behavior, the U.S., NATO, and Ukraine are setting themselves and the world up for disaster. Here we have Scott Ritter explaining what dangerous situation we are living.
I wanted to join the military when I graduated high school. I wanted to join the military for the sole purpose of closing with and destroying the Soviet enemy through firepower maneuver. Kill a commie for mommy. I believe that. Better red than dead. You're darn right. I mean, this was serious stuff. Those were the bad guys. We were the good guys, and I lived it. I grew up. While everybody else has learned how to tune cars and chase girls in the United States, I'm literally living under the shadow of imminent nuclear demise. I wanted to be a part of that. So I did. I joined the Army out of high school, went to West Point Prep. Long story short, me and the Army didn't see eye to eye. So I got out of the Army and went to college and got my commission in the Marine Corps, which was more to my liking. Post-Vietnam War, United States Army wasn't my cup of tea. Marine Corps was. And I was also, talk about political inclination. Ronald Reagan, Republican, man, died in the wool, Ronald Reagan guy. First president I ever voted for, Ronald Reagan. I almost got kicked out of college because the day Reagan was shot, I was down in the student union, and one of those long-haired hippies said, I hope they killed the guy. And I put him up against the wall, punched his face in, had to be pulled off, go to the dean, and they threatened to kick me out of college, and I threatened to call the Secret Service and say, what are you doing about a man who's threatening the life of the United States president? Why do you allow people to speak about the commander-in-chief that way? So we reached a compromise. I promised not to punch anybody in the face anymore. They promised not to kick me out of school. But I graduated as a dyed-in-the-wool Reagan Republican, joined the Marine Corps, where I spent the next couple years learning how to kill Soviets. Literally, that's all we did. In 29 Palms, California, we trained day and night to kill Soviets. I was in a field artillery unit. My one of the more frustrating things was carrying out the big exercise. So I was up in the command post, and exercise going well is exercise in Iran. The Russian, the Soviets were coming in. We're supposed to block them from reaching the warm water ports. And, we're moving Marine units on the map, and there's always more Russians than there are us. And eventually they break through 1st Marine Division, and they're moving in on Kabahar. So in comes 5th Battalion, 11th Marines. We pull up the self-propelled 155-millimeter howitzer, load in the nuclear shell, boom, fire off the nuke, bam, we stop the Russian division. Next thing we know, they say, index, exercise is over. I said, well, what happened? They said, oh, the Soviets retaliated, we're all dead, exercise is over. And that was sort of the first wake-up call about the terminal impact of nuclear war. Index. It's all over. There's nothing left to talk about. Just clean it up, go home. You're all dead. That was a wake-up call. So I spent a long time trying to figure out how to survive in a nuclear environment. Bottom line is you can't. You can't survive. Once the nukes go off, everybody dies. In 1987, Ronald Reagan signed the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty with Mikhail Gorbachev. And because I studied Russian history and Russian language in college, playing football and beer at the same, drinking beer at the same time, so my language wasn't that good. But they handpicked me to be part of a Department of Defense activity called the On-Site Inspection Agency. I was a first lieutenant, which is very junior, in an agency where the next junior person was a senior major. The average rank was lieutenant colonel, and colonels were a dime a dozen. I get thrown in as a first lieutenant, and somehow I've managed to finagle my way into being the first inspector on the ground in the Soviet Union when the treaty was being implemented. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is the 1980s were a very dangerous time. I talked about growing up. I talked about being in the Marine Corps. I talked about the imminent threat of nuclear weapons. It was real, especially in the form of intermediate nuclear range missiles. These missiles, the Soviets had a large number of them. And there was a huge crisis in the 1980s when the United States decided to deploy its own intermediate nuclear range missiles, the Pershing 2 and the ground launched cruise missile, in response to the Soviet developments of a missile called the SS-20. The Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty was going to get rid of all of them. All of them. I'm not talking about arms control, limiting the numbers. All of them. In one fell swoop, an entire category of weapons that literally threatened humanity because we were on a razor's edge, ready to go to war in Europe. One mistake, the timelines. Pershing 2 fired from West German soil impacts Moscow in 7 minutes. There's not too much decision-making to be done in 7 minutes. It is launch, fire, everything goes. It's not, will we have a tailored response? Will we see what they're hitting? Can we come up with, can we escalate to de-escalate? All this garbage that think tanks come up with, they talk about nuclear conflict. It really doesn't work that way. It literally is a missile coming in, hit the button, fire everything, get it all out, and destroy the world. Because that's what deterrence is. Deterrence isn't about negotiating down the consequences of nuclear war. Deterrence is, if you ever use a nuclear weapon against me, I will destroy you and everything on this earth. Therefore, don't use a nuclear weapon against me. And yet, we both had them, and they were both forward deployed. In 1983, we had an exercise called Able Archer. And Able Archer tested the nuclear launch command and control of NATO nuclear forces. But the Soviets were watching it saying, I think they're really going to launch a preemptive nuclear strike. So they put their entire SS-20 missile force on alert, ready to fire at a moment's notice. And had there been a hiccup, one little hiccup in Able Archer, the SS-20s would have launched, and that would have been it. All she wrote, Europe's gone, everybody's gone. We got rid of those. It was a wonderful thing to get rid of these weapons of mass destruction. You know, you talked about today, people, like you mentioned, people coming up and, you know, saying, hey, maybe we can launch something and sneak it in on them. Let me tell you about a little incident that took place while I was an inspector. We had a what we called a crisis, a missile crisis. We had a giant X-ray machine. And the Soviets ended up shipping out three missiles that they didn't want X-ray. I won't get into it. You can read my book about it if you want to learn the background. But these three missiles went out. And, you know, long story short is, they left the factory without being x-rayed. As soon as they left, we were able to get the x-ray machine up. And everybody's scratching their head going, why? Why would they do this? What is the purpose of sending it out? Turns out that those three missiles were the final shipment of a series of missiles that looked like SS-25s, but they weren't. They were missiles called the Serena. The Serena, you see, carries a communications package instead of a warhead. And the Serena goes to a regiment that continuously keeps missiles in the field. And what is the purpose of Serena? It's tied to a system called the dead hand perimeter. You see, if the United States thinks for a second it can launch a debilitating attack against Russia, let's say we got lucky and we took out Putin and all of his command and control. The dead hand actually has sensors around, sensors that monitor seismic activity, sensors that monitor radioactive fallout, sensors that monitor the lack of communications, meaning that if people aren't checking in on time continuously, then what happens? The dead hand, called the dead hand because everybody could dead and it's still going to go off, the dead hand fires Serena missiles, and the Serena missiles fly over the Soviet Union, sending out launch codes, and everything is launched automatically. Guys, there's no such thing as a surprise attack. There's no such thing as a surprise attack. You can't win a nuclear conflict. You can't. It's simply impossible to do. But here we are today. We're in a situation, you know, something happened today. I don't know if people, I hope Americans are able to cut through the propaganda and stuff and listen to Russian President Vladimir Putin's speech that he gave today on the occasion of incorporating four former Ukrainian territories into Russia. You know, I'm not going to sit here and be Putin's shill. I just want people to listen to the speech and understand the seriousness of what he's saying. And you don't have to agree with him. You can disagree vehemently about the decision to incorporate these territories, but listen to what he says about relations between Russia and the West and understand that we are literally on the edge of the abyss. And it's a very dangerous situation. You know, all those missiles that we got rid of in the 1980s, the success of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, it's been undone. The United States, of course, withdrew from the INF Treaty in 2019. It no longer exists. We're talking about deploying these weapons. We have usable nukes now, the W-76-2 low-yield nuclear warhead that we've mounted on Trident missiles, on Trident submarines. They exist for the sole purpose of giving the commander-in-chief, that's the president, flexibility to tailor a response to any Russian action that may occur. That means tailor a nuclear response. So this notion that the United States has signed a joint statement with the other four permanent nuclear powers, being France, United Kingdom, Russia, and China, that nuclear war can't be won, therefore nuclear wars should never be fought. I mean, that's the statement. Everybody signed it, shook it, and yet we develop weapons that are by design to be used in a non-nuclear environment, that we will use nuclear weapons preemptively. That's what the W-76-2 is. The first time it was tested, the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, I believe, went to Omaha, where he initiated the command and control, simulating the launch of a W-76-2 against Russian forces. Normally, we launch against, you know, northern, you know, you know, beef jerkyistan, or we would come up with some sort of weird name for the fake enemy. We weren't faking it. It was Russia. We're launching a nuke against Russia. Not because Russia nuked us, because Russia had broken through and was threatening to, you know, advance on Poland and the Baltic. So we used nukes to stop them. Insanity. But that's what defines this current situation. Insanity. Right now, you hear a lot of talk in the West that Russia is losing this conflict, that Russia is lost, that the reason why they're mobilizing 300,000 troops is proof positive that they've suffered overwhelming casualties. that their military is not as competent as we thought it was. All I ask for people to reflect on that is, if the Russian military is so incompetent, why did Russia just absorb 20% of Ukraine? I don't think that's the end result of an incompetent military. The other thing is, the Ukrainian military, and everybody in NATO knows this, has suffered crippling casualties. The number of casualties that have been incurred, the Russians recently reduced the number of 61,000. I think that's a low ball, especially given the current offensive. I think that number is closer to 80,000 dead, not casualties, dead. And then you take the wounded, the Russian figure of 40,000 is a little low. Normally, one would expect like 2 to 3 times as many wounded as you have dead, except it reflects the reality of the battlefield. Russia so dominates the battlefield, and the Ukrainian command and control is so incompetent that many Ukrainian soldiers who otherwise would survive are left to die on the battlefield. And that's just a harsh reality. So anybody who talks about America and Europe standing up for the Ukrainian people or standing up for Ukraine, understand that we are empowering a government that doesn't care about its troops, that literally sacrifices them needlessly on the front, not to serve Ukraine's interests, but to serve the interests of the United States and NATO in containing and subduing Russia. But Russia is not going to allow itself to be contained. It's not going to be subdued. But there's a lot of talk now that this mobilization is an act of desperation, that if Russia is to go on the offensive, Russia will have to use tactical nuclear weapons to punish Ukraine and to break the will of the Ukrainians. So now the United States and NATO are desperately saying, well, what do we do? What do we do if the Russians nuke? Let's back up for a second. Russia published a nuclear doctrine in 2020 that says nuclear weapons can be used on one of two conditions. The first condition is if nuclear weapons are fired against Russia, or if Russia detects the launch of nuclear weapons that are more than likely going to hit, Russia releases everything, the world ends. As Putin says, you're dead, we're martyrs, we go to heaven. You go wherever you go. But that's it. The second one is if the national survival of the state is put at risk. Now, that's a broad term, national survival. What is the survival of the Russian state? I think the Russians have made it clear that these four new territories have been incorporated into Russia. Any effort to forcefully recapture these territories threatens the national survival of the state, and Russia will use whatever means necessary to prevent that.
Indeed, using a hypothetical Russian tactical nuclear attack on Ukraine as a working assumption, the Biden administration has developed a range of non-nuclear options in response, including a decapitation strike targeting Russian leadership, to include President Vladimir Putin. According to Jake Sullivan, President Joe Biden's national security advisor, the White House has communicated directly, privately, to the Russians at very high levels that there will be catastrophic consequences for Russia if they use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Jake Sullivan noted that the Biden administration has spelled out in greater detail exactly what that would mean in its communications with the Kremlin. Just to be clear, the White House has communicated to Russia its intent to respond in a non-nuclear manner to any potential Russian nuclear attack against Ukraine. Colonel Douglas McGregor believes that Putin won't use nuclear weapons unless the U.S. use them against Russia. He describes how catastrophic could be the use of nukes.
It's worse than exaggerating. It's nonsensical. Putin has made it very clear on numerous occasions over many years that the idea of using a nuclear weapon against a neighboring state is effectively off the table. And as your Russian official pointed out, the Russians do view Ukraine as another Slavic country that is very closely related to Russia. So the idea of any sort of weapon of mass destruction like that has been off the table from day one. I think the nuclear scare is largely invented in Washington, D.C., and it's designed to scare the West, particularly West Europeans, into thinking something could happen that won't. The only way that a nuclear confrontation could occur would be if we launched a nuclear weapon at Russia. We are not going to do that. The people inside the White House may be confused and disappointing in many ways, but insane isn't one of them. There will be no nuclear confrontation. There will be no nuclear warheads involved in this war. So forget it. Well, remember that one of the chief reasons that President Putin finally decided to move into eastern Ukraine was that we had reneged on our promise that we would not put theater ballistic missiles, strike weapons with nuclear warhead potential on the ground in Ukraine. And when it became clear that that promise was not going to be honored, along with a lot of other promises, he said, we've got to go in. We've got to clean out eastern Ukraine, and then we've got to achieve neutrality for the Ukrainian state. I don't think that position has changed. I think it's the same. And I don't see anyone in Washington who is contemplating the use of those weapons. Now, there are people in Washington who talk about it. Fortunately, they are not in the chain of command right now. They're not in a position to make that decision. The notion that you have something called a tactical nuclear weapon is dangerous. And this is something that the Russians understand very well. The use of any nuclear weapon will lead rapidly to escalation, simply because the side that is the victim will conclude that if it does not use its arsenal quickly, it will lose it. So there will be no use by the Russians, and I don't see any evidence that we will do it. This war will be settled with conventional means, high-end conventional means, and many, many weapons that are very destructive, but they're also very precise. The Iskander missile, Kinzhal missile, these things are devastating weapons. Some of them have been used, but not to the extent that we are likely to see them be used now. But none of them will have nuclear warheads on them, and we know that.
Former German Chancellor Angela Merkel said that while the West has been adamant in its support for Ukraine, it should also keep its mind open about Moscow's future role in Europe's affairs. She stressed that a future European security architecture within international law will meet the requirements only if it involves Russia. She added, as long as we haven't achieved that, the Cold War is not really over either. Earlier, she urged the Western world to take Putin and his words seriously, arguing that such an approach is by no means a sign of weakness, but rather a sign of political wisdom. Douglas MacGregor describes that this war won't end well for the U.S. and Europe, nor for Ukraine.
I think that we will rapidly become absorbed here in the United States with our own internal financial and economic difficulties. The same people who think, for some reason, that you can hike interest rates, defeat inflation, but not cut spending, that you can still peddle bonds to the rest of the world when the Japanese and the Chinese are dumping our U.S. treasuries. These people are also claiming that Ukraine can win. They're wrong. Those things are incompatible. Those things are not going to happen. The entire Western world is going to be consumed this winter with the financial and economic crisis that is developing. So that's the first part. Second part is the Russians are exactly what you said. They're deliberate. They're methodical. They're going to put together these offensives. These offensives will be launched, I suspect, certainly when the ground freezes, no later than mid-November, and these offensives will sweep everything before them. And we, on the other hand, will sit there and say, well, we're sorry, we did all we could, and the Ukrainian people will suffer for it. We have no strategy. We simply have no strategy. There is no systematic approach that defines the desired end state, how to achieve that end state, and what the real purpose of the mission is. If you ask anyone, what are we doing in Ukraine? The answer is, well, we're degrading Russia to make sure Russia can never do this again. It's all nonsense. There is no specific end state other than, let's see if we can destroy Russia. Ukraine is an opportunity for us. We'll intervene, we'll set up a government, and then we'll exploit the Ukrainian people to weaken Russia, and perhaps we'll be successful and will eliminate this obstacle to total global financial domination by the United States and the dollar. It's ridiculous nonsense. The World Economic Forum is part of it. The people in the West, the elite class is part of this. It was a terrible miscalculation. It's not going to work. It's going to fail miserably, and we are going to be in serious crisis. So the best answer I can give you is that these people were opportunists. They thought they could do something they can't. It's failing. It will fail. And the consequences for us will be enormous. I mean, look, NATO is really in ruins at this point. Anybody who looks at it objectively knows the Europeans are not mobilizing nor have any interest whatsoever in a war with Russia. They thought NATO existed to stop wars in Europe. They thought NATO's purpose was to avoid future wars. They thought the EU was there to promote peace and prosperity across borders. All of that has been turned on its head by Washington. Washington is failing. It won't work. All we have to do at this stage, I'm afraid, is take the abuse that we will from the mainstream media and from the politicians in Washington who will depict us as deranged traitors. But in the next 60 to 90 days, that picture will change tremendously. And when it does, we will do what we have always done. We will stop talking about Ukraine, change the subject, and talk about other things. Because in the final analysis, what happens in Ukraine has never mattered strategically to us. For the last 30 years, if you wanted to make a great deal of money and be successful in Washington, you aligned yourself with people like Madeleine Albright, Sandy Berger, and so forth. Those people and their descendants or their clones are in power now. And I think that's why you see retired generals one after the other show up and declare their loyalty and confidence that Russia will be defeated and so forth. I'm simply saying I see a sea change coming. And whenever you get a sea change, there are lots of windsocks in this city. They will change direction too when they see that the direction of the political winds have changed and the economic winds. But more important, I think you will see new personalities emerge. The sad truth is that our system has never been a very good one for foreign and defense policy. We tend to lobotomize the government every 4 to 8 years, as my friend Chaz Freeman likes to point out. But this time, I think you will see a true lobotomy. I think a lot of these people will be swept away in the disaster that lies ahead. And that disaster is not war, it's economic disaster.
Thanks for watching. If you like our videos, please hit the button below to like and share it.
The weapons being sent to Ukraine are formidable from a dollar amount perspective, and Ukraine credits the U.S. military aid with its degree of strategic successes, such as they are. But as we saw with Afghanistan, or indeed with the so-called war on drugs in South America, not all the weapons are necessarily reaching their intended destinations, and not all are even appropriate for the particular applications at hand. We could be, in effect, laying political landmines as armed militias and factions grow richer and fiercer through the conflict, only to emerge, like the Taliban, as formidable forces accountable to no one, yet posing a threat to all. Amit Sengupta, host of the podcast Geopolitics Simplified, shed some light on the matter, and we have a brief report from CNN from several months ago about the degree of accountability regarding the actual distribution of the weapons the U.S. and others are sending to Ukraine.
So the big question is, who is paying for all the weapons that are being sent to Ukraine? Now, before I answer that, have a look at the list of weapons country-wise. The following countries have been supplying Ukraine with weapons. You will notice the leader among them is the United States, and then UK, and then all the European countries who are also part of the NATO alliance. One must not even have an iota of doubt, Ukraine has the support of the United States government, UK government, and the European countries' governments. And let me also tell you this, currently Ukraine is completely broke. They even need financial assistance to keep their basic infrastructure running. That is the first part of your answer. Ukraine is not paying and cannot even afford to pay for these weapons that they are getting to fight against Russia. And if you have been paying attention to the news, whenever Ukrainian President Zelensky makes any weapon demand, United States or UK or any other European government's head, whoever approves the demand, those weapons by and large are being sent from their existing stockpiles. For example, if Ukraine demands HIMARS rocket launcher from the US government, then the US government has to give it from its own existing stockpile. I hope this much is clear. Now, the next thing that you have to understand is, every country has its own arsenal or stockpile of weapons. It is not like whenever there is any demand, only then the government manufactures it. Every country's government has certain amount of reserve weapons. That means these existing stockpile of weapons have already been paid for. Citizens of respective countries have already paid for these weapons in the form of taxes. Now, whether United States military uses them or any other country uses them, all you have to do is just keep an account of the weapons that have been actively used. After all, the purpose of any material thing in this world is not to be preserved for ages. They have to be used because they have a shelf life. Plus, if you look at the list of weapons, they are not something that is state-of-the-art or cutting-edge technology weapons. These weapons must have been lying in storage facilities for decades, and there is also cost associated behind storing these weapons. If you don't use those weapons, then every year your storage cost keeps on adding. So at some point of time, it makes sense to use those weapons. Otherwise, what was the purpose of manufacturing them in the first place? Suppose if you don't use those weapons, then you have wasted money in manufacturing them and then storing them. And then at some point, if you don't use them at all, you will have to dispose them or recycle them. So either way, if you see there is cost. The US government knows that now is the time to drain Russia both economically and militarily, without having to engage directly. It will be cheaper for the United States to stop Russia now than to do it 5 or 10 years later. Because the fact of the matter is Ukraine is completely destroyed. Forget about that. No one is going to rebuild Ukraine. It has become the next Afghanistan of Europe. But for the US government, this is the cheapest possible way to take down its adversity. Simply, the US government has to do is keep giving these old stockpiles of weapons. Have a look at Germany, Poland and nearby countries of Ukraine. They all have been giving Cold War era tanks and weapons to Ukraine. This will clearly tell you that these countries are getting rid of their old arsenal. Even United States has given M113 APC, which is from the Vietnam era. Then they have also sent a dozen of F-15s and F-16s to Ukraine, basically donated. Simultaneously, US has also supplied hundreds of modern suicide drones. So the point I'm trying to make is, the Western countries are sending only those kind of weapons which are either obsolete and they want to get rid of it. And they are also sending those kind of weapons which they want to test, so that they get the A++ ratings, which will ultimately help in boosting their weapon sales. So please don't think that the Western countries are helping Ukraine out of humanity. They have outsourced their war to Ukraine. So this $33 billion military aid to Ukraine might look very noble. You can also use the word donation, although donation is not a right word. US government is simply transferring older and retired weapons, and the US government has created such a situation wherein they are helping American weapon suppliers, that is the US weapon industries, by getting them new weapons purchase contract from the European countries and also from other countries around the world. There is another way how the US government is benefiting. You must have heard that in the month of May, Joe Biden temporarily suspended all kinds of tariffs on the import of Ukrainian steel. Now there is a reason why countries have tariffs on import. It is to restrict import of certain goods so that the domestic producers get a price advantage on locally produced goods. Suppose if you don't have import tariffs, then the foreign product is going to flood in your market and your domestic producers are going to suffer because they will not be able to compete. Now along with that, even the US government is going to benefit from import tariff as a source of revenue because any kind of tariff or tax is a source of revenue for the government. Now think about it. Why did the US government temporarily suspend all kinds of import tariff on Ukrainian steel? The reason that is given by the US government is that they want to help the Ukrainian economy. That is why they have temporarily lifted import tariffs on Ukrainian steel for a period of 1 year. Now this sounds very noble. However, you must also realize that even the steel industry in United States and in many European countries are feeling the economic crunch. So by eliminating import tariffs, it is going to benefit the US market. And Ukraine is supplying steel at a low cost to United States and other European countries. And in return, the West is sending old weapons to Ukraine. You see, on the face value, it may look like donation, but it is not the right word. No one is doing any favor. Money, credit, everything is being adjusted here and there very diligently. But on the face value, it sounds very noble that US is helping the Ukrainian economy. If you read all these government policies very carefully, you will realize that the whole cost of this war is being adjusted here and there. This so-called $33 billion military aid to Ukraine is neither a donation nor a loan. It's a very carefully thought-out package of aid that is going to help the United States in long run, and the US companies are going to benefit from a reliable market situation that has been created due to this conflict. Similarly, apart from the $33 million military aid to Ukraine, US government has also given subsidies to the US farmers to increase the production of crops such as soybeans and wheat. Again, if you look at the reasons given by the US government, this subsidy is towards meeting global food shortages. But in reality, US government is encouraging their farmers to grow grains and make them flow into the free market of Europe. Before this war, Ukrainian farmers were known as the Europe's breadbasket. But now, after this war, United States government's subsidy to its own farmers is going to make the US agricultural market more profitable. And if you notice, the $33 billion military aid to Ukraine was announced on 28th April. And the farm subsidy was also announced on the same day. So what I'm trying to say is that all these military aid that the US government is giving to Ukraine, it is neither a donation nor a loan. Think of it as an investment. It's a very carefully drafted financial package that is going to help the United States in long run. And the US companies and industries are going to benefit from a reliable market situation that has been created due to this Russia-Ukraine conflict. I hope you found this video informative. Thank you for watching it.
As you know, the U.S. is sending high-powered military hardware to Ukraine. But what happens after it gets there? That is the concern, sources tell us. So far, the U.S. has sent more than $2.5 billion worth of military aid to Ukraine, including a new shipment that landed in the region just this week with helicopters, howitzer cannons, and military drones, among other things. CNN's Katie Bo Lillis is following the developments for us. Katie Bo, is the worry that these weapons could potentially fall into the Russians' hands at some point?
Not exactly, Anna. According to our sources, the risk is a little bit more long-term than that. U.S. officials acknowledge that there is a possibility that at the close of this conflict, some of this free flow of arms could wind up on the black market and could end up in the hands of militaries and militias that the United States didn't intend to arm, similar to what has happened in past conflicts where the United States has armed one side or the other. But the reason for this, Anna, as you mentioned, is that the United States doesn't have a terribly reliable way to track what happens to these arms after they cross the border into Ukraine, what units they go to, how they're used. I want to read to you how one source briefed on the intelligence described this to us. This person said, "We have fidelity for a short time, but when it enters the fog of war, we have almost zero. It drops into a big black hole, and you have almost no sense of it at all after a short period of time." Now, there's a couple of reasons for why this is. One of them is that many of the arms that the United States is sending are smaller man-portable systems, things like shoulder-fired rockets and single-use drones that are easy to transport, and certainly far easier to transport and more difficult to track than things like large air defense systems like, for example, the S-300 that Slovakia sent. The other and perhaps most critical reason that these arms are difficult to track, Anna, is that the United States military is not in Ukraine. It's not embedded with the Ukrainian military, and therefore making it that much more difficult for the U.S. to keep a strict inventory of where these munitions are going and how they're being used. But at the end of the day, this is a calculated risk that the Biden administration has been willing to make. As one defense official told us, they view the risk of not adequately arming Ukraine as a much greater risk than the potential that in the long run some of these arms might end up on the black market. Anna.
Katie Bo Lillis, thank you for your reporting. Let's bring in Colonel Andrew Milburn. He is a retired Special Operations Commander in the U.S. Marine Corps who has now set up a military training center for Ukrainian troops, and he's joining us in Kyiv, Ukraine. Colonel, thanks for taking the time. Thank you for your efforts. How can the U.S. guarantee that the security assistance being sent to Ukraine doesn't end up in the wrong hands?
Anna, that's a great question. By the way, great pleasure to be here. Good evening to all of your listeners. And I'm going to answer your question. I'm just going to say how wonderfully circumspect and balanced the previous reporter was when she said that the means of ensuring that this staff, logistics, supplies get in front lines, and I'm paraphrasing here, is not terribly reliable. My guys here, who are all former special operators from across all services, and we have got Brits here and various nationalities, they have a term for U.S. logistics supply within the country itself. And I'll just say the second word is show. But it's not a particularly complimentary term. And there's good reason for that, okay? You know, you guys have hit on this. I would say that the very last concern that the United States government should have right now is that these arms end up in the wrong hands, all right? I mean, they are ending up in the wrong hands, but through no malign intent. They are piling up in Lviv, all right, which is the western part of the country. People will get a mistaken impression that Lviv is near the front line because, you know, a few missiles hit the city the other day. But by and large, Lviv is remarkably secure for any part of Ukraine. And yet, when you go to Lviv, it's packed full of NGOs. There's hospitals. There are warehouses bulging right with U.S. supplies. There are well-kitted out troops. Because that's as far as it goes. You know, the bottom line is this: you lose control of logistics supply system unless you have your own guys manning the nodes. Again, not through any ill intent, but there's no one who's motivated or to get the stuff out of those warehouses through frontline units. Local commanders, quite understandably want to take care of their guys. I would love in the back room here. I've got a commander who just came off the front line. He's going back there tomorrow. Actually, we're going with him down to the southeast. It's just about a six-hour drive. He is short of everything. He's a special operations commander. He had six guys die 2 days ago in casualty collection points. They bled out through lack of tourniquets, lack of individual first aid kits, no trauma kits, lack of training, lack of equipment. And well, so it's a bit of a joke to read in papers. Sorry, I'm go ahead.
No, forgive me. I have so many questions for you, and I want to make sure that we get a chance to discuss a number of things. But wrap up a little bit about this whole supply chain issue when it comes to the weapons. I know we've been reporting, and correct me if the reality on the ground is different, that, you know, there are challenges in getting equipment and aid of any sort, humanitarian aid, military aid, to the places that need it most because of Russian bombardments of those, you know, supplies moving in different parts of Ukraine, hence why perhaps they're stuck in Lviv, which is a little bit safer and more secure for everybody who's in that country right now. I do want to ask, because of your experience as a former special ops commander for the U.S. And your role now in helping to train Ukrainian forces, what is the number one piece of equipment you need or they need right now?
Number one, drones. Okay, so unfortunately, very much a lot of publicity has been given in the news to the Turkish TB2 drone, which has performed magnificently here. But there's only a handful of those things, and they're kept at the drone command within the armed forces of Ukraine. Not a single unit that we have spoken to, actually with the exception of one, I'll talk about that, has anything other than the DJ-1 drone, which is Chinese manufactured, totally susceptible to geolocation of its user, totally vulnerable to Russian jamming, interference, and, you know, frankly, a piece of crap. We've just seen a handful, the first group of U.S.-made drones make it to the front line, and they were hand-carried, and they're hand-carried by my guys who train units on the front line. That's, you know, by the way, sorry, I should take a step back. I suppose you call it CEO of a non-profit organization called the Mozart Group. And what we do here, we're not an NGO. We can't be an NGO because we train people. And training people includes training them to use weapons and kill people. But we do a lot of what we do is what you might call humanitarian. And drones are not, you know, the drones we're delivering are not lethal weapons. They're used to, you know, for what we call ISR, reconnaissance from their lines. As Ukrainians, as they transition into the offense, we hope, then they're going to increasingly need what we call Type 2 drones with longer range. They do not have them at all right now, except for these Chinese the pieces of trash. That's number
so
one.
So is part of the issue that... Go ahead.
Yeah, so number two, medical gear, all right? There's you know, and medical gear is, it's one of the favorites for non-government organizations. They're pouring it into the country. It does not get beyond Lviv. The guys on the front line are not just simply spouting. We have visited units that are short of medical equipment. I'm talking simple first aid kits. I'm talking trauma kits. As I mentioned, this case of a commander, you know, in the kitchen behind me, losing guys in his casualty collection points is not unusual. It happens all the time. Mm. Everything from the point of injury to getting guys into hospital. The casualty rates among Ukrainians are not publicized, but are much higher than they should be. And for those of us involved in this war and reading all this ridiculous attention to what the U.S. is doing, it's heartbreaking to hear the real stories.
Well, Colonel Andrew Milburn, thank you for sharing with us, shedding some light on what's happening and the efforts there to keep this fight going. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Anna.
Well, there you have it. More perspectives on the conflict in Ukraine to help deepen your understanding and perhaps challenge assumptions to help you be better informed. As I said in the opening remarks, I'm not necessarily endorsing the positions articulated by the speakers in today's show, but I feel they have enough merit to warrant critical review. We'll be back to ruffle your feathers, or pique your interests, or stir your passions next week at this time, here on Conscious Voices, as we try to do every week here on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 FM and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and we'll see you next week. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM. WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
You're listening to WGRN 94.1, Columbus Community Radio, The Green Renaissance.